Welcome back to the Football Talk podcast, and in this special episode we'll be looking at the latest developments on the fan-led review of football governance. We're joined by ex-Wimbledon, Liverpool and Spurs legend John Scales, who also has three England caps to his name. More recently, John has become an ambassador for Fair Game, a group of football clubs, and I quote, seeking to find long-term solutions to the deep-rooted problems that threaten the game's very survival. We're also joined by Graham Hyde, who is the vice chair and the media spokesperson of the Leeds United Supporters Trust. And finally, we have chief football writer for the Yorkshire Post, Stuart Rayner. Before we start the conversation, some background. The Fan-led Review was formally established following a number of major events in the English game: the disappearance of Bury FC, the impact of the pandemic, and the attempt to form a European Super League. These events led to a general outcry from fans, owners, and commentators, and called into question the suitability of existing governance. The review was chaired by Tracy Crouch, MP, and following the publication of the final report in November 2021, the government has endorsed the findings and plans to publish a white paper on the subject later in the summer.
YorkshirePost.co.uk.
And let's head straight into the first question. The first of the 10 recommendations was that the government should create a new independent regulator for English football to ensure the long-term sustainability of football. The government accepted this recommendation, so let me start by asking John whether he still thinks that this first recommendation is absolutely essential as a starting point.
Yeah, I do. I mean, I think, you know, right throughout this process, it's been clear that the vested interest in the game, the conflicts, all the issues that we've known for a long time about football, you know, that exist, I think, in my belief, hold the game back and don't serve the game and the interests of all the stakeholders in the most adequate and most appropriate way. And actually, the game can flourish much more if it is managed and regulated and has a framework around it that is fit for the purpose for the 21st century. There's a lot of, as I see, sort of mission creep with all these organisations. That's inevitable in every industry. There are old habits that die hard, you know, with a game that is on so many levels brilliant. It's very easy to sort of paper over the cracks and say that, you know, be careful what you wish for. So it's not without due consideration. I think that certainly we at Fair Game have come forward with a load of recommendations, and you know, obviously that chimes very much with the fan-led review, because good people within football, experts, academics, people who have lived and breathed football and have got great experiences, are all part of that process. So, and remember that we've been through this over the last 30, 40 years a number of times. So, again, I think we reached a point where, you know, it's been well thought through. There's been lots of debates and discussions about these points in the past, and very much so over the last 12 months throughout this entire process. Mm-hmm. So I think, yes, independent regulator is at the heart of the Fan-led Review and the future of football.
Graham, what are your views on this?
Well, I think it's essential that we don't let go the possibility of positive change. Much as sort of John said, I think there's a sense that there are vested interests within the game, and they often align to protect themselves rather than to think about what is good for the overall game. So I think whilst ever we can see that actually taken forward and come and move forward, I think we're going to see something positive that bears fruit. And I think it'd be a shame to sort of let things go now, having got this far.
Stuart?
Yeah, I mean, I think the vested interest point is the main one, essentially. You know, when we have all these discussions, like for example, you know, whether the season should be suspended because of COVID and how the league should be decided, everyone's making those decisions, understandably, through the prism of what will this mean for us? You know, if we vote for this, will we be relegated? If we vote for that, will we be promoted? And obviously those vested interests change from season to season as to what position you are in the league or what your financial position is and all that sort of thing. So it needs somebody to just take a look at things with, you know, just from an outside perspective. Somebody who who the people within the game trust, you know, and choose and support, but who do so, you know, without looking at it just through the eyes of one particular club. And I think that's really important.
Well, and that's the critical point, you know, is, you know, positive change, good change, you know, it'd be worse to have a bad regulator, you know, of course it would. And I think that's the sort of stick that people sort of beat this argument about is, well, you know, you're going to get a regulator and they're not going to understand football. It's going to be imposed by the government. The government, when they regulate things, don't really understand the industry or whatever else. And, you know, football's better off with the people who know football best. And, you know, going to the 2 points there, it's very much getting good people who are trusted by the stakeholders, trusted by, you know, the fans, the clubs, the players, the media, the, you know, all these various federations, associations, and actually have an independent view, which is holistic about the game and effectively, you know, in many ways sort of saving owners from themselves almost, you know, and certainly saving the game from bad owners. So it's a big task, but one that, you know, absolutely necessary.
Because, I mean, I see that the main sort of topic with all your answers is that the self-vested interests of people like owners. And we've seen that when this first was sort of suggested to have an independent regulator, a number of owners or members that were part of the hierarchy at different clubs were saying, do you really need to do this? Do we really need to be part of this? Because they use the excuse of saying that this could damage or further jeopardize the sport that we know and love. And when I was reading that, I was thinking, there's more to that. That there's surely more to their sort of pushing back.
I think you're right. I think there's more to that. And I think ultimately we know that owners, that those whose decisions are very, very much self-interested a lot of the time in terms of their own protective situation, in terms of their investments, the way that they do things, will make decisions that seem to work for them. What they also then do is they make decisions that work for them or their particular level of football. And football is such a bigger pyramid in the UK that we need to be making sure that we are protecting the deeper pyramid. So Premier League clubs, once they've reached those riches, will want to close the drawbridge and keep more of it to themselves and happily vote for amongst that, because that's how they do it.
Premier League clubs as well. I mean, they're looking at it in terms of once they reach a certain level, they're looking at trying to compete with the top Spanish, the top German clubs, sort of things, and that skews their perspective as well, sort of thing. But ultimately, you know, there's enough money within the game for it to be shared fairly and to give everyone a chance. Because if we create a position where one or two clubs are just so far removed from the rest, we end up with an uncompetitive game that people don't want to watch, and that ultimately damages everybody. You know, what we need is a system where players can come up through the ranks. You know, look at John's career. It's not about everybody starting at a top club. Players need to come through the system, show what they can do, develop, and it benefits, you know, the Liverpools and the Spurs of this world, that clubs like Wimbledon are producing players like John Scales and honing them for people higher up the pyramid. So we really do need to look after every single element of the game and not just focus on the top end.
I think there's an element of that when you think about that ultimately their vision of what is good for the game and what the game looks like going forward is, as you say, skewed. That they don't necessarily see the game in the same way as to what is important. It seems to be that we increasingly are going down, you know, a never-ending growth in terms of the cost and the finances at the top of the game. But actually, is that detaching it from the working-class game that it traditionally was? Are we now basically seeing a situation where, as the money flowing through football is so vast, that the need to feed that beast calls on owners to come in different angles just simply to feed it? And that's where we get things perhaps like tying up with, you know, kind of fan tokens and cryptocurrencies, which most fans are not interested in or don't want, but simply it's about feeding that beast so that they can continue to grow economically.
And turning to the our second question, can we now look at the potential impact on supporters? The government supported the recommendation that supporters should be properly consulted by their clubs in taking key decisions by means of a shadow board. And although the Golden Share proposal was watered down to require proportional and flexible proposals which work for clubs across the football pyramid, Graham, can we start with you on this one? Do you believe that the interests of fans are likely to be protected, or do you fear that unscrupulous owners will find ways around this regulation?
Board representation is a really, really strange one to do, because ultimately where you have fans groups and they are larger organisations, this commercial sensitivity of what's discussed at standard board level is obviously very, very difficult to then share and make public. And if you've got individuals from a fan group there, they are now no longer able to share any of that information. With sub-boards, you can operate them as truly consultative advisory boards, but it's also highly likely that clubs will put some kind of puppet organisation or puppet board in place, where in effect it's simply a trickle down, here's some information so we can claim that we're keeping fans in the loop, rather than truly consulting them and seeking advice, you know, and acting as a genuine board that they consider the opinions of. So I think, yes, we will find owners that will say, look, we'll pick a load of individuals that we know are very compliant in terms of what we say, and we'll just tell them a few things. But ultimately, we won't really take on board what they're actually saying.
You know, I think you've got to look at why the conversation about shadow boards and golden shares and, you know, all these things have been muted to such a degree. And if we're not too careful, we put in so many new regulations on the game that actually we do cut our nose off to spite our face. And so I'm concerned about that. Fans' voices, fans' representation is important, but why are we doing that? I think we're doing it because the trust in the game has gone. Trust in owners, ownership has gone to a large degree by fans, certainly with the breakaway league and with other aspects. So I think if we suddenly go too far, then we're going to make football very difficult to be able to be the sort of competitive environment that needs to be. We've skewed too far towards the sort of financial aspects of football. We've forgotten too much of the custodianship and the responsibility that owners have with clubs, and that balance needs to be addressed. Go too far, and that is my fear. Of course it is. Right here now with Fair Game, we're looking and pushing, and the fan-led review, it looks at all these aspects. Taken all together and imposed on the game altogether, then that might be too severe. So the independent regulator, so what I'm coming back to, is the independent regulator hopefully gives fans the trust and the confidence that clubs are going to be run much better. We maybe come and mention our sustainability index and the idea of the stick and the carrot. You know, the stick have been the ability to audit clubs and make sure that they report properly and they run their clubs well. And the incentive is maybe that this sustainability index rewards clubs that fulfil all the obligations and do good things in the community and the EDI. So this whole shadow board thing what I don't want within the game personally is the tail wagging the dog.
I think, as John says, it is just about balance. And, you know, the very best run clubs don't need a shadow board. The problem is the other clubs, you know, a really well run club will listen to what its supporters have got to say and take that into account. Exactly. You know, and if in an ideal world we would have, you know, 92 owners who did that, and it wouldn't matter. But it's always a balance, and a delicate balance. You know, if it was purely down to what's best for the match going fan, you'd probably have every game at 3 o'clock on a Saturday. But the flip side is, if you did that, you wouldn't have all the millions and millions and millions of pounds that's poured into the game by Sky TV, by BT and everyone else, which then allows us to, you know, buy players and attract, you know, managers of the quality of Kevin De Bruyne and Jurgen Klopp and all that sort of thing. So it's just getting the balance right. And it feels at times, you know, some of the kickoff times, some of the late changes and things like that just really, you know, are insulting to fans in terms of how little consultation there is. You know, the FA Cup semi-final debacle we had where fans couldn't get home by public transport, things like that. But it's just a balance. There are some sacrifices that have to be made to to bring the money into the game. But equally, there has to be a point where we can say, no, this is too much. And even the rules we have at the moment in terms of when the television companies are supposed to announce these changes and that sort of thing aren't being adhered to. And that's where you need a strong regulator and strong authorities to just step in and say, look, the fans aren't being properly respected. This needs to be done properly. Mm.
Which, I mean, it, in my eyes, sort of contradicts the main message that was being shouted from the rooftops during the European Super League fiasco, which was, it's the fans that make the sport. And I was thinking, okay, fine, if that's the case, why don't you look after us how we expect to be looked after? And do you think having something like the Golden Share, like the 50+1 structure that is currently being used in Germany quite well, could work over here in the UK?
If you think about it in business, you know, business takes the voice of the customer incredibly seriously. And I think when we talk about things like, yeah, the fans at the heart of it, we have to almost consider, are we the customer as match-going fans, or are we part of the product? And if we are customers, then they should be listening to us because we are what will be driving this. But if we're simply part of the product for TV, well, if that's their viewpoint, then we can understand why they keep shifting all the match going things around, because ultimately, you know, we're just the hired help, except we're paying for the privilege.
I think another difficulty is, you know, you use the business analogy, and it's the big problem with football. You know, if you're not happy with the prices your local supermarket are changing, you just switch to another supermarket. Mm-hmm. Well, a Leeds United fan, a fan of any club, can't just flick a switch and say, I'm going to stop supporting Leeds United today. I'm going to go and support Bradford City or, you know, whatever. That's the difficulty. Those loyalties really get preyed on. If you are treated as customers, it's not so easy to just sort of play the market as you would in any other, you know, any other sort of walk of business.
Mm. Great thing about the Super League fiasco was the fact that it was stopped by the fans within about 48 hours.
Yeah. Yes.
So in a sense, it was they became the best regulator of all. But of course, you know, there are for that one example, there are a thousand where fans have not been treated appropriately and properly within the game and are taken advantage of. They are the customers. They should be listened to or respected more. They are the lifeblood of the game. They are everything about the game. When I was, you know, just this weekend talking about, you know, Web3 and NFTs and the whole crypto, you know, the whole future of that aspect is, you know, so many people are looking at fan data and the way they engage and absolutely putting and recognizing that the fans are at the heart of everything about this game. So there's the sort of the hypocrisy sometimes the way in which they're treated with kickoff times, as has been talked about, and then at the same time about, you know, looking into new markets and new opportunities and saying that they're the customers that they need to serve.
Mm. Oh, and actually, what I would say in relation to that, just to build on that point about the data and about the collection of customers' data and how it's used looking at Web3, NFTs, crypto, socios, etc. as an example, what you've then got is the clubs preying, to use the word a moment or two ago, preying on that loyalty of fans and selling them as a product to third parties. Now, we've always had organisations and businesses who marketed their client database, but this is potentially pushing people into unregulated space on the basis of the fact they absolutely know that loyalty is so prevalent in that relationship. So it is, whilst it's a business relationship, it's a very special business relationship. And it's why having a regulator that can stop abusive relationships in that point of view would be welcomed.
Yeah, I mean, there was some amazing footage recently about a Valencia game where all the Valencia fans gathered outside the stadium while the match was going on to protest about the way the club was being run. But it's just, you know, you see things like that, but they very, very rarely happen in English football because the loyalty is so strong. It's such a difficult thing to ask a football fan to do, to not go into a game or to walk out after X number of minutes or not walk into X number of minutes. And again, that passion that fans have is something that the more unscrupulous owners can prey on. You know, it gets to the point of where they can say, well, yeah, you fans don't like this, but what are you actually going to do about it? And as John says, the Super League was a rare example of the sort of right balance being struck by supporters to stop things. But it's a very well, difficult thing to ask a fan to not turn up or whatever.
Yeah. The irony of it was that, you know, the biggest and so-called best clubs in the world came up with an idea so unbelievably stupid, worries you, you know, that they are incapable of having the best interests of the game at heart, or their own best interests. That was the death knell of themselves, in effect. You know, within 5 years, that have just wouldn't have believed what they'd got themselves into, I believe.
Mm. Just on a slightly interesting note around the Super League, European Super League, and we talk about fans being at the heart of the protest. Obviously, I was at the heart of that Leeds United protest with the plane flyover, all of that lot. We were sort of the first instigators. And in part, that was done in combination with the club. So that was driven, you know, a conversation between myself and Angus Kinnear at Leeds United, who said, right, we're going to do this, the fans are going to do this. And even though, you know, kind of it was a fan-led protest on the day against Liverpool, it was something that was done in conjunction with the football club. So it's not to say that fans can't be close to football clubs and can't find when things align and can't drive protests in the right way together. But as you say, when you've paid £35 for a ticket, are you likely to walk out halfway through? And, you know, it's an expensive sort of part-time hobby if you're not going to the game.
I mean, there's one example that that always springs to mind when we talk about things like fans being mistreated and stuff like that. And for me personally, it would have to be using Blackpool as an example, who, as we know, had a really turbulent time under the Oyston family. And when they ended up getting to the playoff final to get up to League One, barely anyone showed up. And I know, it's like you said, Stuart, it's incredibly difficult for a fan to just say, do you know what, I don't like this owner, I don't like the way it's being run, I'm going to go somewhere else. I mean, a number of Blackpool fans ended up going to AFC Fylde, another local lower league team. So that's one example of how it can work and what the result can be. But again, as you say, it's incredibly rare, and it's incredibly evil for owners to sort of prey on the loyalty that the fans have for their club.
It is. I mean, look at some inspiring, you know, despite the gloom and you know, maybe I'm a bit out of my depth on this one, but when you look at the glory of football, when you look at Bury, you look at Blackpool, you look at the demise of things and these owners that are so reckless and greedy and self-absorbed, and actually disaster befalls, you know, or people leave the club. And look at the renaissance of Bury. Look at Wimbledon, the story of my club, and how AFC Wimbledon has risen from the death. You know, look at Blackpool, how people will then come back with new owners. They'll force out bad owners. You know, that power is immense. The pain is enormous. But that sort of rebirth of the game and the club and the locality and the community and everything else, you know, seems to come through in the end, however painful that journey is. It just shows you that the collective spirit within football and football supporters and fans is just overwhelming ultimately. But we all don't want that to happen, to go through that pain, which is why, again, we come back to the findings of the Fan Led Review, the independent regulator. We should never be in those situations in the first place, of course.
And turning our attention to the third question, on the subject of the qualities or otherwise of owners, another key recommendation is that new owners and directors tests are introduced to ensure that only, quote, good custodians and qualified directors can run clubs. We've all had experience of owners who have been hated by supporters and whose custodianship of the club has been questionable. And it's clear that existing tests are, well, in my eyes, at least, inadequate. But what do you think the new tests will need to do to keep out the so-called undesirable, Stuart?
Well, I think I think part of it, as I've sort of alluded to with other things, it you know, in some areas we've got regulations that aren't enforced strictly enough as it is. So that's the first thing that we need to do. But beyond that, I think they certainly need tightening up. I mean, there's always going to be incompetent owners, you know, owners who make bad decisions for the right reasons. That's just the way of competition, and that's what happens. It's the unscrupulous ones that we've really got to be on top of. I think, you know, the owners and directors test, it talks about not allowing people with a criminal record for dishonesty to buy clubs. Well, why not just a criminal record? You know, why not just be a bit more picky in that regard? You know, I've heard it said that it's kind of a wider issue that maybe states shouldn't be allowed to, you know, buy individual clubs or, you know, organisations closely aligned to one, like the Saudi Arabians owning Newcastle United. I think that's something to look at. And I think there's also a case for sort of reviewing it on an annual or maybe every 2 or 3 year basis to see that these people are actually sticking, you know, still sort of seen as good honest people and sticking to what they promise to do. I think there should be more transparency in terms of who owns what shareholdings in some clubs and where the investment comes from as well. I think that's important, you know, given the rules about dual ownership and things like that. So I think these are all things that need to be done, and they need to be done as openly as is possible. It's difficult with big financial transactions to reveal everything in public, but I think there needs to be a degree of transparency so that supporters are confident that the rules are actually being applied fairly, and that they can have confidence in the people owning their club.
Yeah, I think Stuart makes a very good point there. You know, it's a raft of rules altogether that collectively, you know, many of those rules are in existence today, but they're not enforced properly. You know, yeah, you're right. You know, keep out, you know, criminals, fraudsters, you know, unscrupulous owners. That's the whole point. So that there must be full disclosure, and therefore, you know, some of that stuff may not be on full public record, but certainly to the governance, it is. And, you know, maybe, you know, an annual license as part of that, where the compliance with reporting and declaring and transparency of the club ownership and that is such that football is managed and controlled in a much better way. I think it's not beyond the realms of expectation to think that we can govern the game of football and the ownership much better. Many of those rules are in place. It needs some tweaking, no doubt, but then this raft of various aspects together will make drastic improvements, and without stifling the sort of the way in which we've got a great game. We live in an age where they, you know, clubs need to access capital and they need to speculate and they need to, you know, get players and they need to, you know, be able to borrow and finance and do all these things, but within the scope of sensibility and not reckless. Where the club's future is put at jeopardy, I think it's not too much to ask that those things can be put in place.
I think the challenge is, in part, we've seen over the last sort of couple of decades or so, at least, that football has proved itself incapable of regulating that, though.
Yeah.
What we look at the EFL and some of the challenges in there. I mean, you want to look at owners that perhaps have had criminal records. You know, Massimo Cellino at Leeds United was a great example of an individual who really should have got nowhere near a football club. The Oystons, a great example at Blackpool. If you look at the challenges around, you know, Wigan, individuals who didn't have a penny pretty much to their name, who then in effect put the club into an almighty world of turmoil. When you get to the Premier League, you get to a situation where the members club votes on whether they let people in, whether these owners are fit and proper. And ultimately, it's so loaded with that self-interest that we talked about earlier, that they're saying, oh, well, we don't want a nation state coming in. for whatever reason, because ultimately they don't want somebody competing at the top end against the other clubs that are privileged at this stage already. It's the same league that allowed basically the Russian rubles from Abramovich, and it took a war to change that.
And that's why when people come out and say, oh, we don't need an independent regulator. I mean, Graham could have kept going for another hour and listed examples. Mm. You know, we do need an independent regulator because these things are happening. And football can say, oh, well, we'll sort this out. We'll sort the redistribution of money out. Well, they're not doing it. They're not, as John says, they're not applying their own rules. They're just not doing the job. And we've been waiting far too long. It has reached a stage where the government is going to have to step in and say, right, you can't be trusted with this anymore. We need an independent body, and we're going to leave them in charge. And it's the only solution.
Mm. Yeah, it is difficult. I mean, you know, not to get too controversial again, you know, back on, you know, the Abramovich situation was, look, his money was in the UK banking system for many, many years and accepted within the banking system and a regulated industry or whatever else, I'm sure. You know, that money was in and around. And, you know, I'm also against sport always being the sort of the one that gets kicked to pieces to be the example that has to suddenly come in and set the example. It should set the example, but at the same time, there has to be consistency within, you know, business practice within, you know, within the country where you're operating. And I think some of these conflicts or some of the hypocrisy or contradictions do baffle me sometimes about the way in which it's what's good for somebody is not good for somebody else, and the consistency does.
I wouldn't say for one second that our banking system is flawless, and certainly in this situation, you know, the source of money that comes into the UK from areas around the world really needs looking at in terms of a wider money laundering picture. Because they view that sort of fragility in our banking system and can take advantage.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, it does feel like sometimes football's held to a higher moral authority than everyone else. You know, it seems a bit, it was a bit bemusing. There was all this debate about whether the Saudi Arabians should be allowed to buy Newcastle United in a country that sells arms to Saudi Arabia. You know,
that's my point. Yeah,
exactly. It does feel like sometimes football's held to an even higher, you know, moral level than our own government and businesses and what have you. And John's exactly right about that. Sometimes we need to just rein it in a bit and be a bit sensible about it. But obviously, you know, it's such an emotional game and such a high profile game. People will use it, you know, to push their own agendas. Mm-hmm.
And on to our next question. The recommendations also included a suggestion that the Premier League guarantee its support to the pyramid by making additional contributions. This suggests that the current approach to distribution is inadequate for those further down the pyramid. But is there a danger that this could possibly damage the Premier League and ultimately all of football? Starting with John on this one.
Look, I think the Premier League, you know, the percentage of money used to be about 25%. I think it's gone down to 16%. There's a push to put it back to 25%. It goes down through the pyramid. We talked earlier about the development of players, that the, you know, the my experience and my route through, you know, the second division down to the what was then the third division back up to the top flight. You know, it's about nurturing and developing talent. It's about nurturing, developing the game. It's about the pyramid system. It's about distribution. Of course it is. You know, what you don't want to do is just give more money to the poor, if you like, and they just spend more and waste more and are ineffective, inefficient. It's about actually what's good for the game and actually distributing money down through the leagues and into the grassroots of the game actually serves the interests at the top of the game, I'm sure, and I'm convinced, very, very well. So again, you know, there's a balance to be struck on that. I think there's efficiencies. I don't like the pyramid, parachute payments, the way in which, you know, relegated clubs earn so much. I understand the principle where we've just seen, what was it, the weekend, you know, the great Brighton suddenly climbing four places and being incentivized to finish the last game, what looked like a dead rubber, you know, and, you know, I don't know what it was, 10 million more. So that game became incredibly compelling and watchable. You know, that's an obscene amount of money, but it sets the principle of how competitive the Premier League is, what a great global attraction it is, and how that drives huge amounts of revenue distributed back through the pyramid. Well, I think is essential and good. So, you know, I would like to see the Premier League guarantee more support down through the pyramid. But again, that's why we talk about the Fair Game Sustainability Index, to ensure that money is distributed in a way which is for the good of the game, and it ensures that it doesn't go into the pocket of unscrupulous owners.
Mm.
I think it's just about, you know, maintaining competitivity as much as we can, and therefore, you know, the numbers will constantly need revising as things go on. But, you know, you look at things at the moment, and, you know, the Premier League is a two-horse race. You know, for all that's happened over the season, we've still ended up with the big six finishing in the top six. You know, we've still ended up with Watford and Fulham going down to be replaced by two clubs who've won automatic promotion on having parachute payments. You know, we've still got Rotherham and Peterborough swapping places between Championship and League One. So there is an element where the league is becoming less competitive because of money. It's not completely that way. You know, there's still room for well-run clubs to punch above their weight and for badly run clubs to struggle. But, you know, for us to be saying, for example, what a big achievement, and it was a big achievement, for Sheffield United to get promoted and finish ninth, and for Leeds United the next season to get promoted and finish ninth, for Brentford to do what they've done, that shouldn't be such a big achievement. But the gulf at the moment is just too big, and we just need to close it up a bit. I mean, I guess the less money that goes to the Premier League clubs, the more is shared around, it will inevitably dilute the quality a little bit. But at the moment, the Premier League is so far ahead of the rest of the world in terms of the money it brings in. I don't think you could really say it's disadvantaging these clubs. These clubs earn so much more than, you know, even the likes of Bayern Munich and Real Madrid and Juventus, that are very top clubs, that they genuinely can afford to just help develop those clubs who they'll be sending loan players to, who they'll be signing players from, you know, and the divisions that you look at Leeds United, they could end up in a couple of years' time if things go wrong, or other teams could go the other way.
Hmm.
I think there's an element when we think about this, we've got to think about the damage that some of that distance between, say, the Premier League and the EFL has done. So whilst we're talking about parachute clubs coming up, the challenge has been for many clubs to literally throw the kitchen sink and the crown jewels at trying to get up. Look at the damage that's been done to Derby by Mel Morris's reckless approach at throwing the kitchen sink at getting up to the Premier League and failing. You know, that's an entire city that ran the risk for months of literally losing their football club because the vast gaps of getting up to the Premier League created such an incentivized situation that an owner was willing to literally beg, steal, borrow, etc., to try and get up there and really gamble the future of a city's football club. And I think, therefore, if we can find a way of narrowing that gap so that the distance between the leagues are less measured, but also I think to get to a point where even within the same division the whole distance is narrowed. The Premier League now, as we've said, you know, the sort of there are the haves that have ridiculous amounts, and then the kind of the okays. And there are a battle of those at the very bottom normally. There are those in the middle who basically just don't have the money to make the next step, which is up to the European game. And then there are those where the money is just crazy. And that whole money loop now has got to a situation where those who are at the top are so well funded by the Champions League or Europe or the money that they're making commercially that nobody can compete. And all they do is drive up the wages. And you're getting players being paid half a million pound a week to play football. Now, I'm not disputing the talent and the management of talent and the cost of talent and how you do that. But it's a loop that is basically a slow train to disaster.
Yeah, I mean, look. I wish I was earning $500,000 a week, you know, but it certainly wasn't back in my day. But you know, I don't begrudge a player going to a club and asking for, you know, $5 million a week. For goodness' sake, you know, it's if a club is stupid enough to go and pay players that amount of money, then more for them. But of course, they need to be saved from themselves. That's a sort of throwaway comment. But there has to be cost controls within clubs. There has to be a percentage of turnover that's spent on player wages. It's the biggest element of a club. You know, and you know, clubs that get parachute payments, that have these gilt-edged contracts for players that when they get relegated, they don't have an automatic discount or reduction in those salaries. It is incredible. And you're right, you know, the talk of the competitive nature that clubs feel obliged to have to put more money in to try and compete with those relegated, that has to be removed, because it's creating a vicious circle within the game that is leading to disaster. So those aspects of tweaking the clauses for relegated clubs, the cost controls within clubs, the income and expenditure, the parachute payments. There's a lot of work to be done on that, notwithstanding the fact that the Premier League is incredibly competitive, and that is a great league that is viewed around the world brilliantly. I'm not just trying to rob from the rich and give to the poor. That's not the aim and objective here. It's to make sure it's a balanced, considered, pragmatic approach to making the game better throughout.
And let's get it straight, Mark. We want losers, because, of course, to have winners, you have to have losers. What we're trying to achieve is the name of John's organisation, Fair Game, just that teams have a fair chance of competing. And if they're not good enough, well, that's fair enough. That's competitive sport. But it shouldn't be, you know, it shouldn't be because they're at such a disadvantage financially. It shouldn't be, you know, as Graham said, that they're having to
compete against Chiefs. They shouldn't be competing.
Yeah, compete against Chiefs.
You know, that's it. People who are reckless and overspending and distorting the game to a degree where it's not competitive, because it's just so unbalanced. That's what we're trying to create.
Yeah. And next. Next question looks at the 10th recommendation, which suggested that the welfare of players exiting the game needs to be better protected. Although the government supported this recommendation, they regarded it as a matter for the football authorities. As well as the psychological issues affecting many ex-players, we're also seeing increasing numbers of players suffering early onset dementia, which Stuart and I have covered in a previous special earlier on in the year. The football authorities have seemed sort of reluctant to bite the bullet on these issues. Can we realistically expect them to take this forward without some form of regulation in place, John?
I mean, it's incredible, isn't it? You know, in any industry, you know, an employee, especially in this day and age, the rights that they have, the responsibility that employers have to their workers, the mental health issues that we see throughout society in this day and age, the overall welfare of players. It's incredible to think that football itself cannot take on that responsibility and understand who has that responsibility for the welfare of everybody involved in the game. And yeah, it really disappoints me if that has sort of been pushed down the pecking order, if you like, or not taken as seriously as some of the other issues of financial regulation or governance issues or whatever else. These are absolutely critical. The amount of stories, the most distressing stories of former players with dementia, of mental health issues, of financial ruin, marriages falling apart, taking their own lives. I mean, suicide. It's just, you know, the game has is better than that. The game has a bigger responsibility than that, and you have to make sure that responsibility is given to the right people. They understand the requirements of them that's required to maybe have that license to operate, or that license to play the game, or to be in the league, or to be part of this football family. So it's a critical issue within the game, and one obviously I think we will all agree has to be at the forefront of any new regime, or certainly made as prominent as anything else.
Yeah, I mean, you know, Graham and I have spent our lives growing up watching footballers, idolising them. You know, it's heartbreaking when you see one of them in capturing any of those problems John's just mentioned, and it's our responsibility to look after them. They give us so much joy. The least we could do is look after them in return, because, you know, let's not forget that one way or another, most of the money sloshing around these football clubs comes from supporters, whether it be through the gate or through shirt sales or through their satellite subscriptions or whatever. It is ultimately, certainly a large chunk of it, our money being recycled, and we want it to look after, you know, these people who have just given us so much joy. We owe it to them.
I definitely agree with that. And I think there's a sense as well that, you know, kind of the game has a responsibility to look after them. I mean, notwithstanding basically the wider society requirement to look after people where things like dementia are a challenge. That's a wider health issue within society that continues to grow with millions and millions of people affected by it. But where we're talking early onset, where there is a link to a specific job role, a practice, a sport that people have taken part in, these, as you quite rightly said, were our legends. These were the people that we worshipped, and we want to see them, and we expect, I think, the game to look after those people that the game has massively benefited from. If we think about those players in the 60s and the 70s that were really sort of, you know, I think at Leeds particularly, that were absolute heroes to many. And yet, as, you know, they get older, you know, many of those now are basically in a situation where dementia could be starting to affect them, or has already affected them, as we saw with individuals like Jack Charlton. For earlier onset, I think these are our heroes that are much nearer, that have been part of the modern game, that has really changed the way football is, that has created this wealth in the Sky era, that has created this richesse and this largesse for modern footballers in terms of some of the crazy ways. And I know that if you pick a player in League Two, that their salary is not much different to being out there earning basically on an office job. But at the top end of the game, the riches are immense, and I think there needs to be something being recycled back in to look after the legends that created football in the modern era.
And finally, before we close, are there any other points that you would still like to raise or emphasise whilst we've still got time? Coming to Graham first.
So I think the key thing for me about the fan-led review is we need to keep that finger on the button and hopefully get the government to press it and implement it, because clubs will push back against it because it takes away their sense of a closed club, a membership club where they make all the decisions, and that they can act in the interests purely of their members.
Yeah. John?
Yeah, I think it's... you know, we just talked on that last subject. You know, players are not a commodity. You know, players are, you know, the lifeblood of the game, and the respect that they deserve, and the value that's placed upon them, and the work and the efforts, and the body that looks after that, you know, is an essential part. Look, but nobody likes change. Everybody always resists change. But I think there's a big job to do to persuade of the benefits, that actually positive change within the game is fantastic. And we've got to be careful that we don't over-regulate, we don't overkill the game, we don't overdo it. But those within who are reluctant to change are scaremongering everybody to such a degree that they say it's all right. They're trying to, you know, do too much. It's going to kill the golden goose, et cetera, et cetera. So I think, you know, there's a real pragmatic approach. We do have to keep the foot to the gas to make sure that the government implement, you know, the best of this fan-led review. It's been done in consultation with some great and wise and wonderful people, and fans have had their say within that. So I think, you know, now is the time to ensure that the game is put in a better shape, and we have to keep pushing the government to make sure that this is implemented now, because we can't put it to the back of the shelf for another 5 years or 10 years when the next review comes around or the next crisis raises its head.
Yeah, I mean, it's been quite, you know, the nature of this podcast, it's been quite negative it's a great game. Everybody listening to this podcast loves football, I'm sure, you know. So we're not looking to rip it up and start again, but there is an opportunity now in the wake of the Super League, in the wake of this review, to just make it better for everyone. And I think too often when the game thinks about how it can improve itself, it doesn't actually ask the most important people, the supporters. And this is a real opportunity for their voices to be heard, and us to just slightly reshape the game so it is a fairer game. It's more like the game we want it to be. But you know, essentially, things are pretty good at the moment. We just want to make them better.
Absolutely.
YorkshirePost.co.uk.
Many thanks to Stuart Raymer, John Scales and Graham Hyde for joining us for this special discussion looking at the fan-led review. But don't forget, you can keep up to date with all the football news across Yorkshire and beyond by logging onto our website at www.yorkshirepost.co.uk/sport. Or if you search for Yorkshire Post Sport, Yorkshire Post Football or even Sheffield Sport on Facebook, you can find us there as well. If you have any questions for our writers, you can get in touch using those various Twitter or Facebook pages, or email us directly with the subject matter as footballtalkpodcast@yp.sport@jpimedia.co.uk. As ever, many thanks for listening, look after yourselves, and bye for now.